Hello and welcome to Serious Vintage. I'm Jeff Mose.
And I'm Nat Mose.
Today we'll be talking about four color humans at Gen Con, vintage in Iowa, and pancakes, specifically pancakes for breakfast.
Hi everyone, we're here with Steven Stearman. He's the humans player from Gen Con. You may have heard of him. He became sort of notorious for demolishing a whole bunch of people.
You included. With,
yeah, including me with a four-color humans list that apparently he put together 15 minutes before the tournament.
Hi, Steven.
Hello.
Hi, Steven. Yeah. I'm glad you could be here. I know Jeff and I talked about it at Gen Con where we needed to get you on the podcast just because you were such a fun and friendly opponent, had such an amazing run both days. It was sort of this aggro deck that came out of nowhere.
Yeah, the conglomeration of standard cards that
every
opponent needed to read.
Yeah, so you had, like, I played against you in the last round on Friday, and it just seemed like you had a blast all day. So I think we were both looking forward to getting to talk to you more.
Oh, yeah, definitely. It was just, everyone there was incredibly fun and friendly, and there's nothing quite as enjoyable as having all your opponents being there trying to figure out what you're doing.
Yeah. So why don't you tell us a little bit, like, how the deck came about? I know we were talking a little bit before and how, you know, you ended up having to borrow cards and throw things together sort of at last minute. You know, what's the story behind the deck?
All right, yeah, so I have one friend that lives down in Cedar Rapids, Brian Potter. I think he cast Acquire on Jeff on Saturday.
Total blowout.
Piping Needle, the bomb.
Oh, yeah.
Wasn't even a bomb, it was Pithing Needle. But, you know.
Hey, it can be a bomb.
Most valuable card in the season from Kamigawa.
It was really good in that situation. Anyway, so.
But yeah, so he's a big collector, and he's always been wanting to play vintage more and more. Last year at Gen Con, he played vintage for the first time in an actual tournament, so he's really excited about doing it this year, and his girlfriend also is a big collector, but he's not so much into playing at the competitive level, and so they offered me and his brother chances to play vintage. And so the basic thing about what we could borrow was, she had Power minus Mock Sapphire and Time Walk and Black Lotus. So also her Ancestral Recall was something like a 9.5 graded alpha, so it wasn't getting played with.
No, riffle shuffle that. Come on.
Yeah. I heard a story about a guy unsleeving his vintage deck and riffle shuffling it to make his opponent just grief quit.
Neat.
Yeah, but so basically, the knowledge we had with those cards being available was that we weren't playing blue.
Right.
So the guy's brother, Luke Potter, spent some time going online, and he found the Human's Intuition thread on the Mana Drain.
Okay.
He kind of combined a couple lists people had made to get his, basically what he thought would work or just be really the most fun to play.
Okay.
And so we, Saturday morning, he had already decided he didn't want to play vintage. He wanted to do another tournament.
Oh, this would have been Friday morning.
Yeah, I want to play vintage.
Yeah.
I mean, I'd already played block the day before, which was a format I'd never played before. So I was like, you know, block and vintage, that's what people, you know, they play both those formats together, right?
Right. Oh, sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
They're like the same.
The smallest format and the largest format. That's common targets for one player.
Right. I did enjoy it because I'm pretty sure I'm the only person to play in both those formats at Gen Con, probably for the last 20 years or something.
Oh, yeah. That could be true.
But so as a result, we didn't finish throwing the deck together until about 5 minutes before the vintage tournament started.
Uh-huh.
So, I mean, we were talking a bit earlier about that's why there's some funky choices. For instance, the Imperial Recruiter was supposed to be another Oath of Ghouls. But we couldn't find an Oath of Ghouls, and for some reason, none of the vendors brought any with them, so.
I like that you replaced Oath of Ghouls with the Imperial Recruiter. How much markup is that?
Yeah, that's funny, because, looking at that list, Imperial Recruiter is one of the last cards that I would question, because it seems so right in there.
Right.
Exactly, and that's why it never came out, because it worked really well.
So what you're telling us is that if you want to play Vintage, you should get into the format the night before and then finish your deck 15 minutes before the tournament.
Exactly. I mean, that's the record for success, because I won my first 6 games of
These were the actual, have you tested the format before? Have you played other games of Vintage?
Well, I had, before that time, I'd once played one match, I think, of Vintage with Brian Potter and his girlfriend had proxied up decks. That was a year ago, right before Gen Con.
Nice.
So that was the first time that I ever actually played a match. Otherwise, leading up to Gen Con, I solitaired a couple of the combo decks, so I knew how all the combo decks worked pretty well.
Right.
Granted, for my deck, that knowledge didn't come in too useful. It basically meant, how important is Thalia?
Right, sure.
Do I need her turn one, or can I play her turn two?
Right, yeah. So, did you learn anything else? I mean, have you read things about Vintage and knew the decks, or was it really just sort of, here's your aggro deck, go ahead?
I'd done some research beforehand.
Okay.
With MTG Top 8, I just basically spent a while looking through all the decks, getting ideas. And Brian had suggested to me Brian DeMar's articles on New York City.
Yeah, sure.
So other than that, and then just a tiny, tiny bit on the mana drain was all I had. That was also one of the really awesome parts about going to Gen Con was that I was able to ask people before about where should I start going if I want to get into Vintage, and I think it was Jacko handed me a business card for Eternal Central.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
So I have it in my wallet, it's just like, ooh, it's embossed. I mean, it's a high quality card, I mean.
Jayco spares no expense.
It's true. That's so true.
That's awesome that you were able to just sort of just pick this up and use what you had learned from other formats and what you picked up online from Vintage to just go in and start smashing people.
Did you feel like your inexperience was helpful at all? And you were just going into it swing and not, I don't know. I mean, I feel that sometimes if you don't know what to watch out for, you just don't fear anything and you just get into it.
Right.
To some degree, maybe, though, I mean, I don't think I ran into a single card over the weekend that I didn't know what it did, because I play a lot of EDH, and so between EDH and Legacy, and for my deck Standard, I had played at least against all the cards before.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Do you think that, because I think one of the first things you told me was that this was your first Vintage tournament, and I'm wondering if you told anyone else that, and maybe that made them underestimate you, and keep bad hands, or just try and go for things that they couldn't actually do, and you were able to capitalize on that?
The only time I ever had anybody seem like, or I thought they were making an error was against you where you spell snared my, I think you was my confidant.
That was totally on purpose.
Yeah, exactly. I didn't it's uncountable with Cavern, because.
I know.
I want my elemental, and it's like, oh crap. Those things are gonna be the death of me.
No, that was totally on purpose. It's like, what else am I gonna do with this? Yeah, so what did you end up playing against both days? I mean, did you feel, you must have felt comfortable in most of your matchups, because I think you won, obviously you won most of them. What was your record on Saturday?
On Saturday, I ended up 5-2.
Okay.
My two losses were to a Bugfish deck and a Young Pyromancer deck, of which both those guys made top 8.
Oh, okay, yeah.
I actually played 3 Young Pyromancer decks on Friday. And the one that beat me was a guy that knew what all my cards did.
Oh, yeah.
So, I mean, it was grossly unfair. I mean, I cast my Master of the Fells, and, I started offering it to him to read, because that's what everyone had been doing all day.
And you have to read both sides of it, too. Right? That's...
Well, exactly. And that was, I think it was against one of my Young Pyromancer opponents. I played Huntmaster, And then when it flipped and killed his young Pyromancer, he just said, wait, it does that too?
Yeah.
And there was a time where, you know, I was able to swing and he blocked wrong because he didn't read that the Huntmaster had trample and...
Oh.
Yeah, but then this guy, he played standard, so he knew the Huntmaster, and I played Oath of Ghouls, and his reaction was just, oh, I played that in Carador counter.
Yeah.
Sometimes I'm like, oh man, this, all my tech just gone. I can't unnerve them.
Right. You have no tech that's secret, right? Well, let's talk about some of your one-ofs there. I mean, I think the actual part of the deck, the Deathrite Shaman, Noble Hierarch, Mirror of Avabrook, Thalia, even Casale Pride, Banestar Confidant, I think those are all fairly standard. Even when you get to the actual removal, Abrupt Decay, and Swords to Plowshares, those would be pretty common in this. But then you had, 8-10 one-ofs? I mean, they're sort of, they're all very good. It's just, you know, what made you choose those one-ofs? I'm looking at the Saturday list. I don't know if you made changes between Friday and Saturday.
Yeah, there were only a couple minor ones. Probably one of the biggest changes that, you know, there's two Sting Scourgers in the sideboard.
Mm-hmm.
Those are main board for Friday.
Okay.
And the basic train of thought behind them in the list, you know, and this one thing's where the guy who made the deck wasn't entirely fluent in Vintage. He'd mainly seen that suggested by people in the past and such, but it was near useless for me.
Well, I think that the Sting Scourgers are there to protect against Tinker, which your deck normally would be fairly soft against, but I think that there was probably record low Tinker at Gen Con.
Yeah.
Exactly. That was the main thing, because I figured when I go against a Blightsteel deck, I can still bring them in.
Yeah.
Because it seems good. Other than that, I had my three Swords of Plowshares. I didn't auto lose to it, but...
Right.
But no, I mean, that definitely would be it. But actually, in one time in between rounds, on Friday, I played against Brian Potter, the guy who was lending me cards.
Right.
And he was playing his blue with a splash of black Tinker control deck.
Sure.
And he got, I think, a turn one or turn two Tinker into Blightsteel. And I just played Cavern, Naming Warrior, Sting Scourger.
Nice.
He just sitting there with the Force of Will blue card in his hand. He's really...
Blow out.
Yeah.
Speaking of Cavern of Souls, that card was just insane in it.
Yeah, Cavern is really good.
I mean...
Especially against things playing blue.
Yeah.
I know we were looking at your land base because you have, I think it's 4 Deathrite Shaman and 3 Noble Hierarch.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Which seems like it's a lot of mana fixing, but you only run the 3 Wasteland. Was that a decision, or did you not have the 4th Wasteland?
I had the 4th Wasteland. It was actually in the sideboard.
It's on the board, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, the biggest problem with it is that the colors were so tight.
Yeah. You're playing Orzhov Pontiff and Huntmaster of the Fells, for example.
Exactly. Yeah, so just as a result, it just got put on the board. I kind of wanted to be able to make it work after Friday to play it.
Yeah.
But I didn't want to cut a creature for it, and that's the only thing I could reasonably cut.
Because you just needed those colored mana sources.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, and Orzhov Pontiff, speaking of it, I added him in for Saturday because I played against the 3 young Pyromancers.
The young Pyromancers, right.
Yeah, we were talking about it. We were like, Orzhov Pontiff, what does that do? Oh, it probably really blows out young Pyromancer decks.
Yeah, sure it does. Did you actually get to play it against young Pyromancer?
I did. I think the most I ever got with it, though, was 2 tokens, though. There's one time where I got a Bob and a young Pyromancer, so...
Nice.
I was gonna say,
it also kills the Pyromancer, doesn't it?
Yep, exactly, yeah. So it creates a nice one-sided board wipe.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And it's a human, so Cavern makes it uncounterable.
Right.
Yeah,
yeah, that seems really good. I was looking at the three standouts seem to be the Orzhov Pontiff, which we've already talked about, Huntmaster of the Fells, and Exava, Rakdos, Blood Witch. And so what went into those three cards specifically, when obviously we've already talked about the Pontiff?
Right, yeah. The Huntmaster just... I mean, it's one of those things where I can't remember who I was talking with, because it was one where on Saturday there were things where people would be like, wait, you're the guy playing Huntmaster in your deck? Yeah, what's your record?
Yeah.
4-0, I get to tie into top 8 now.
Yeah.
Because the people completely not believing it. And so I remember one guy laughing goes, you know, honestly, my deck has no way to deal with that.
Right.
Yeah,
and the flip being able to kill so many relevant creatures, because I actually found it really funny that Snapcaster Mage is really annoying for my deck, because one thing I'm doing constantly is attacking with things like Dark Confidant and Mayor of Aberbrook.
Right.
Cards that will trade with Snapcaster Mage, but I really don't want to.
Right, sure.
And so, just having the extra ways to deal with that was nice. Exava the Blood Witch is just an amazing Jace killer. And she kind of has pseudo-hexproof in that she can't be bolted and she can't be Abrupt Decayed.
Right.
So, and I don't even know if I played against a white opponent that would have been running Swords to Plowshare over the entire weekend.
Yeah. I mean, it probably would have been in a sort of a fish deck or maybe Bomberman or something like that. And then, so all of those were good for you? Like, I know that on Saturday you resolved Exava against our friend Tuan, who was playing Workshops. He was going to be unable to deal with that.
Yeah, and that's thing, it just, it's one where it's almost just hilarious how you look at the card and it's an intro pack rare. It's worth something like a quarter for a non-foil one, so... And just having it be able to just completely smash phase because it's really hard to deal with. If they're not playing a Worm Coil in their deck,
right,
they probably don't have a straight answer for it.
Right. Well, I mean, their answer for it would normally to make it unable to resolve.
Exactly.
By casting cost, probably. So it's if it resolves, they're already in a bad situation. And then it's just the nail in the coffin because it's, what, 3-3 first strike, right? So.
With Unleash, so then it becomes a 4-4.
Right, yeah.
So, but yeah, it just kind of ridiculous. So, oh, I guess it could be dismembered, but
right.
I did have one Mud opponent. He dismembered something of mine, but he had Trinisphere out. So it was interesting because he had to pay 3 mana plus 4 life to deal with some creature.
I think that actually was Tuan.
Yeah, I think I remember that discussion.
I know there was a big question about how Trinisphere and Dismember work together.
That's right, I remember that. Yeah, I think game one against him, he had out the one that makes all spells cost one more, a Sphere of Resistance.
Yeah, Sphere of Resistance.
And so I got to play the Ingot Chewer for 6 mana and just start beating face with it.
You hard cast Ingot Chewer against him?
I actually got to kill 2 people on Saturday with hard cast of the Ingot Chewer.
Man, what was he doing?
Savage.
Yeah.
Wow.
Hardcast Ingot Chewer is pretty much the best way to win against Chop. That's just like total blowoutville for them.
It's because it just lets them know that they're already losing because you resolved a 6 drop, or you resolved a 5 drop rather. Wow.
Because I think he had 2 Mutavaults out, and I played, and I had two Noble Hierarchs out. So just, swinging for 5. Go ahead, block. So he had to chump 2 Mutavaults to it.
Wow.
Ouch. Nope. But no, and we were talking about how with 7 mana making dudes, you would be a Shop's nightmare because they just can't shut down your overall mana production. It's just too much of it.
I played Shop twice. I won the first time I played against it in 3, the second time in 2. And when they would play Trinisphere, I'd be tapping stuff down and still playing my stuff. And then it basically was time walking me at one point.
Yeah.
My loss against Shop, the game loss, was he turn 1 Worm Coiled and Chalice for 0. And normally that's not, the Worm Coil obviously is very annoying.
Oh yeah.
Normally it's Chalice annoying. For 0 means nothing against me, except I kept a 1 lander with 2 Moxes in it, so.
Yeah, that's rough.
Yeah, so he won that one, I just kept playing land so I could see more of a deck. I think he strip mined my Cavern on Squirrel.
I just
playing land, just be fine. I'll see more of your deck as you kill me.
Right.
And then, he would not let me cast those squirrels, which, I mean,
that's rough.
So, looking at your mana base beyond those, I assume with 24 lands and 7 creatures, that you must not have had a problem with any of your colors all day, because I mean, you're even looking at with the 4 wastelands and the strips, like, you seem like you have a lot.
Right, yeah, and that was the thing, Dark Confidant wasn't as reliable, Shaman wasn't as reliable a mana dork as it normally would be, because I only have 8 cards to actually enable it between the Feshes and the Wasteland and the Strip Mine.
Right.
But for creatures, Cavern of Souls pretty much would smooth out my mana base enough I didn't have any trouble.
Yeah.
The spell I had the most trouble casting was Liliana of the Veil.
Right, because Caverns doesn't do anything and it's double black.
Right, exactly, and so Hyar can't get help out with that, and so
and
that was the reason that she was only a 1 of in the deck, because there was at least once where she basically just locked the game out for me.
Hmm.
where I just was able to keep the blue deck from drawing anything as I did my Thalia beats.
Right, sure.
But other than that, she might have been my most sided out card, but I think that's also because I was playing against a lot of young Pyromancer decks where making them sac creatures when they're making 1/1 elementals with every cantrip.
Right, right.
It just loses something.
Yeah, it's not...
It doesn't quite get there.
Right. It doesn't have quite the luster. So what about... I mean, what other decks did you play? What was your impression of some of the matchups you had? I know you played against Burning Long, at least on Saturday.
I'll be completely honest. I got lucky in that one.
Yeah, I thought so too.
Because I think game one was the time I won the roll. I did turn one, Cavern Aiming Humans, Mox, Thalia.
Nice.
And he just kind of sighs, like, his land, Tolarian Academy, and says go.
Ouch.
He showed me in his hand, he had Tolarian, he kept a one lander.
With Tolarian Academy.
Yeah, and then some like double Mox and Mana Crypt.
Wow.
So I mean, he just had this ridiculous mana hand, but, cause I won the die roll.
Right.
Sometimes yeah. It goes like that. I mean, like you said, you had kept that hand against Shops that was land Mox, and he kept Chalice Zero.
Yeah,
I mean,
he caught you on that one.
That's right, the risk.
Exactly. Yeah.
Exactly. And so, and then on game three, he used Necropotence for, at that point you could only use it for something like Savin, which is still, you know, a new hand and all, but he just ended up whiffing hardcore, so.
That's the Jerry Yang way.
Oh, was that Jerry?
Sure was.
Oh, poor Jerry.
Jerry is the most unlucky combo player I've ever seen.
It's actually really impressive to watch him play because the worst possible thing that happens does.
There's video of him playing Mind's Desire for, is it 8?
I think it was 8.
And nothing. It's like all mana.
Oh, God.
It's like Mind's Desire for 8, pass the turn. Yeah, so I mean, that's not really unexpected, except this. So what else, I mean, what else did you play against?
Let's see, I played against Doomsday.
Okay.
That one was, I won one of the games with just the early Thalia riding it to victory. Another one was, I think it was against him, where he got a turn one Mind Sculptor, and I had sided in, on the play, and I had sided in Red Elemental Blast.
Nice.
So I just untapped, well, I just drew for first turn, Red Elemental Blasted, and said go. So, he gotta use, basically he gotta use the Black Lotus so he could Brainstorm.
Right. Yep.
Yeah. Wow. Blowout. Yeah.
So what ended up beating you then?
What beat me on Saturday was Mark
Lanigra?
Yeah, Lanigra.
I can never remember Hal Seal's last name. I end up playing against him with his Grixis color-wise Jace Control.
Yeah.
So it's basically just mono blue, splash black for Tutors and Yawgmoth's Will red for Lightning Bolt.
Yeah.
But, part of it was that I met him really early in the weekend, and so we were just talking and BSing the entire time because Brian was good friends with him, and so he introduced the two of us and was telling him how he's ripping it apart with the humans deck with Exotic Master. And he was just shaking his head, not believing it.
Yeah, yeah.
But so it had the downside that when I played him in the quarterfinals on Saturday, he knew almost exactly what my deck did.
Right.
And so as a result, he kept hands that were very combo-tastic.
Yeah.
So he was 4th seed, I was 5th seed because I chose the double draw. And he ended up going off on his turn 2, game 1.
Mm.
Game 2, I kept a hand with pretty good action, but I didn't have the early Thalia. And on his turn 2, he time walked and then comboed on that extra turn.
Right.
Yeah, and so both times he drew one of the time ball key and then tinkered for the other half.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that Nat and I were talking about that matchup because we knew that you were going into it, and we thought that your chances seemed pretty good.
Yeah, I actually predicted that you would win. I mean,
unless
just to Jeff, but yeah.
Unless something happened exactly like what did happen, where he just threw together the combo immediately and just won.
Yeah.
Right, exactly. And that was one thing, because I played Time Ball twice on Friday, and I got a decent amount of playtesting against with Brian, and it fell pretty heavily my side because between Cavern and Thalia and then just running the 4 Abrupt Decays.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, Abrupt Decay seems really good against Time Bolt combo.
Yeah.
Well, and he was playing Bob's, I think, too, right? So he had
four Dark Confidants. And
I mean, you had a lot of advantages there, and obviously we didn't know about you or about him knowing what was in your deck, because it seems like it could tilt the scales, especially if he was smart about it and kept good hands against you. But
exactly, and I don't think he mulliganed either game. I think he just had naturally good hands, but it's one where when you know you don't need Force of Will against me. I mean, it'd be different if he was just playing against the dark and, well, this hand can let me combo on turn two, but I lose to any other combo deck.
Right, yeah.
It's good to have good hands.
Yeah. I mean, and that's one thing, that if I would have had the turn one Thalia in game two, I probably would have won, because I always win when I get the turn one Thalia, but...
is that an accurate assessment? Do you feel like that's part of the keys to your victory, is having the turn one Thalia?
I think I only had it three or four times all the games for the weekend, but when I got the turn one Cavern Thalia, the game wasn't even close.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Having Cavern plus a Mox also sets you up for a good turn two and so on. I mean, like, you're already in the driver's seat, regardless of whether you play Thalia or something else.
Exactly, and there's one time I was on the play, I got the turn one Bob, and then Bob flipped over Thalia, and my opponent just visibly sighed.
Well, one of the interesting things about Thalia is that it has first strike, so I'm sure, I mean, if you have a mayor out, I mean, a three-two first striker is actually, that kills most things in Vintage.
Yeah,
that's why Porcelain Legionnaire is decent. I mean, three power plus first strike wins.
Right, right.
And when you make it uncounterable and a hate bear, it's just, I mean, I know Shop just had so much trouble against Thalia, because when I got the mayor out, it killed everything he had.
Right, sure.
Yeah, cause I, the one Shop player that played Wyrmcoil, which luckily I had swords when he played it the later game, but against the other one where it was my second, Shop opponent only had Phyrexian Invokers, and Loathsome Golems.
Right.
And so Thalia was just, I could just keep it back and he couldn't break through.
He couldn't do anything. Right. Did you ever play against Dredge?
I didn't. I got a completely dodge Dredge, which I was very happy about.
Yeah, well, that's always a viable tournament strategy, because I noticed your hate against them seems light. I mean, it's not, you have a Surgical Extraction, two Graft Digger's Cages, and two Rest in Peace, which, I mean, that's maybe not enough, probably not enough against them if you actually faced them. But I know that one of the things we noticed about Dredge at Gen Con was that a lot of it seemed to get knocked out early. Like, there was Dredge there, but it was gone after round two.
Yeah.
Right. And so, with me being able to get my, you know, kind of go on my rampage early on Friday, I think is what really allowed me to go 5-2, because if I had gotten my two losses early and gotten to play against Dredge.
Right.
I mean, because the turn one Thalia only does so much against that deck.
Against Dredge? Yeah.
Not needing to resolve a spell is really good against Thalia.
Yeah.
Oh, I see a Bizarre Baghdad. I'm holding on to my Abrupt Decay.
Right, yeah.
On that permanence.
Yeah. Yeah, so, I mean, that's, I guess, you know, your deck was obviously had good choices in it already, and then you had a little bit of luck to get to where you were, but, I mean, it sounds like, you know, ultimately it was, you were able to outplay opponents in a lot of cases and win.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was definitely interesting, because I know someone, like, you may comment on me telling people that it was my first Vintage tournament and such.
Right.
And I think some people really did underestimate me, because I came in, you know, I'm just trying to be super friendly because I'm playing Vintage. No, I was so excited.
Nobody trusts the friendly guy.
That's really the moral you should take away from this podcast. I was like, if your opponent seems really friendly, just call him and just, you know, knuckle down.
Yeah, kick him under the table. Well, that's awesome. I mean, like I said, we were really looking forward to talking to you. We were following your exploits all weekend. It's great that you did well with a deck that doesn't always do well, and you did well both days. So obviously,
something was going right.
It wasn't a fluke. So.
Right. Well, thank you. And that was one thing he said, because I had one friend comment that whenever he came over to see how I was doing, he could tell what table I was at because there was a crowd around it.
Right.
I met one guy who, he had a friend in the Vintage tournament, and he basically followed me around for a majority of my matches both days because he thought my deck was this most hilarious thing ever.
Yeah.
You know, like, he was looking at one point, he's like, I don't think this could beat most modern decks.
That's one of the things that's interesting in cross formats is that sometimes decks in, like, vintage decks or whatever decks can be really weak to decks from other formats because they're just not tuned.
Right.
Right.
Obviously, no, a vintage deck is not tuned against the modern metagame, and weird things can happen there.
Right, exactly. Yeah. It's just, I mean, the Human Ingenuity really is a metagame deck.
Yeah.
But it means one of those things where near where I live in Platteville, they have Legacy every other Friday, just four round, basically an F&M style event, just for me to play Legacy. And one time this kid showed up with a bad standard deck that was mono black, 20 spot removal spells.
Oh.
I think he went 4-0 because most decks don't run that many creatures and then just win.
Right.
And he got to dodge combo, so it.
Yeah.
All in his favor, but yeah.
Yeah, well, that's great. Would you, if you were to play the deck again, do you know of any changes that you would make or any, you know, any adjustments or cards that you would like to see?
Yeah, I think I would definitely take the Sting Scourgers out of the sideboard.
Okay.
Probably adding some, like, another Rest in Peace in the fourth Swords of Plowshare.
Okay.
Because even though I never played against Dredge, I did side in Rest in Peace once because I went against the Bug Fish deck with Snapcasters, Death Rites, and Goyf. So
right.
I sided out my Death Rites and just brought those in so that I could blank something like 10 of his cards.
Right.
Yeah, Rest in Peace is a house in that matchup. It's awesome.
Yeah.
I mean, other than that, I mean, unfortunately, I can only say so much because I just don't have enough experience with the format, so.
Right.
But overall, I mean, there wasn't really any cards that seemed really unimpressive to me. Liliana of the Veil maybe should come out because of how hard she is to cast, but there are times when she just can win you games.
Sure.
So it's one I'm iffy on, and Oath of Ghouls is another one of those cards where it can be so ridiculous, but it's probably the hardest spell to resolve in the deck. I think I was mentioning this to you guys earlier before we started the podcast because you play four caverns, you play four abrupt decays, so I had all these opponents holding on to their counter magic. So Ventia, I would draw Oath of Ghouls, like, oh, Oath of Ghouls, like, hey, finally, this spell here does something.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you're not going to be doing anything else with them, you have to use those counters where they work. So.
No, exactly, and so that was, I mean, that's one of these, I wasn't able to do so much with this deck, but I've done it in other formats where when counters are really bad against me, for instance, in this deck, it almost becomes worth bringing in more counterable targets post-board because you know their counters are coming out, so I could see putting up Oath of Ghouls in the sideboard or a different copies in the sideboard.
Yeah, cool, because I know when I played against you on Friday, I boarded out at least two Force of Wills. I may have boarded out all four just because for one, they're going to 2-for-1 me, and for another, I'm probably not going to get to use them anyway, so.
Right, exactly.
I just wanted to bring in more removal if I could. I don't remember what I had, but it wasn't enough.
You know, and that's exactly the thought that if your opponents are going to need to bring in all their removal, then Oath of Ghouls would be a great sideboard card, but.
Right. Yeah, well, that's great. Let's talk a little bit about your experience in Vintage in general, because I know this was your, you know, Gen Con was your first actual Vintage tournaments, and I assume, did you have fun?
Oh, I had tons of fun. I don't think I had a single opponent or met a single person playing Vintage that I didn't have at least one joke with.
Yeah.
Where it was just, I mean, everybody was incredibly friendly. And the main reason I wanted to get into Vintage more and more is because of how awesome just the community was at Gen Con.
Right. Yeah, like, we talked about this in our last podcast where we were saying the Gen Con community this year, the Gen Con Vintage community this year seemed especially close and tight-knit and friendly. Like, there were a lot of people who were talking with different groups and, you know, joking around, walking around, and we just had a great time. I'm glad you did too.
I mean, luckily for me, while I didn't know people there, I had the great icebreaker of, yes, I'm that random guy playing Hunt Master.
Right, yeah. So are you going to try and continue playing Vintage?
Oh yeah, I'm definitely going to try. I mean, unfortunately with not owning the cards,
right,
I can only do so much. I have two decks completely proxied up here so that when I see Brian again, you know, we'll just sit down and play Vintage in between rounds at whatever tournament we're doing.
Yeah, good.
Yeah, but otherwise, I know he's trying to add some of the local shops in Cedar Rapids to get proxy Vintage tournaments going.
Yeah, good. It's hard work. It's hard work, but it's worth it. I mean, there's growing interest in the format. I think a lot of people are tentative about getting into it. A lot of people just need to experience it as you have to, as you have, maybe not with all the initial success, but, just to actually sit down and play the game and, you know, actually see some of the interactions and what can happen and that sort of thing. I think people get into it.
Yeah, I think part of the problem is that a lot of people look at it and see, oh, we can play every card. That means there's going to be broken stuff everywhere. And while that's possible, I mean, because I've met so many people have that same thought about Legacy until they actually play Legacy.
Right.
And they realize that, yes, there's a really powerful decks like Char, Belcher, and Tendrils, but there's enough hate for those decks that they make up a very small portion of the...
Right.
Thing. I mean, and that's, for instance, like the metagame at Gen Con, there were very little combo. I mean, I got to run into Jerry and... You know, completely luck sack my way to victory, but.
Right. Well, yeah, I mean, part of it, as you sort of hinted at, a lot of the powerful cards sort of cancel each other out. I mean, like, what you end up having happen is that you're sort of throwing bombs at each other until one sticks, and, you know, a lot of times you can fight one off or counter it with a better one, or, I mean, in your case, you're playing a whole bunch of accumulating smaller things that add up to answer things. I mean, there's lots of ways to go about Vintage that take apart its power.
Yeah, so it's such an open format that when you get in spots like a Gen Con when people want to play so much control, it's just grabbing just what's not expected and being able to mess around with it.
Right. I mean, anytime you can come at a solved metagame in quotes and come with something new and unique, like you'll win games, and obviously you had some luck with that too. So
I definitely got some of the free wins from opponents not knowing what was going on and me just being faced with Thalia and Bob, and they just look at me like, oh, I'm at 4 now. How'd that happen?
That's too late for me to come back. I should have done something earlier.
Nothing.
Yeah, well, that's good. It's good to hear, too, that, you know, there is movement towards actually getting some Vintage tournaments started. I always like to hear about small communities building up. That's obviously part of what we're trying to do with this show. So good. I don't know why I wanted to talk about pancakes. I think it was just because it's fall, so a lot of the pancake recipes that I have are like fall flavors. I mean,
really?
Yeah, well, because I have a pumpkin pancake recipe that's pretty good, and I had recently made buckwheat pancakes that sort of tasted like fall, but...
For me, pancakes and or waffles have always been a Sunday morning tradition forever.
Like year round?
Yeah. My parents have pancakes or waffles Sunday morning every week, every month, all the time. And it's funny because Jeremy Smith, you have met in Columbus.
Right, yeah.
He liked this so much that he picked up the same thing and does the exact same thing. Every Sunday morning he gets up and makes pancakes from scratch.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I make pancakes a lot. I don't do it every week, but it's definitely something that I'll get a taste for pancakes and make them. And like I said, we have a few recipes that we use. I think my favorite one, and I make this one pretty frequently, is actually a cottage cheese pancake recipe.
Really?
Yeah. And it's basically regular pancakes, only you put some cottage cheese in them. And the part of it is also that when you put the eggs in, you actually beat them beforehand so that they're nice and fluffy, like you make a little bit of meringue before you put in the eggs. So they end up just being really light and really creamy, and there's a little bit of nutmeg and cinnamon in them, so they're nice and spicy. They're really good with pretty much any kind of syrup, and they're awesome with blueberries.
Yeah, I have to admit that when it comes to Sarah and I making pancakes, we take a shortcut and we just make Bisquick pancakes.
Yeah. Well, Bisquick make great pancakes.
And I did just, while we were on break, I had my mother send me her best pancakes ever recipe, and it looks like a fairly typical buttermilk pancakes recipe to me.
Okay.
I'll send it to you so we can include it in the show notes.
Right.
I have to admit that going to her house periodically on Sundays, they are really good pancakes.
Right. Well, does she use the actual buttermilk, or does she...
She uses the actual buttermilk.
Okay. I was wondering if she made the buttermilk, but what is that, regular milk and lemon juice that you can substitute in?
Oh, really? I've never heard of that.
Yeah, I think that's
it. This looks like it has a combination of buttermilk and regular milk.
Regular milk, right. Well, I know the pumpkin pancake recipe that we have, that we got from Elizabeth's mother, also has buttermilk in it. Those are really, really good. Yeah, pancakes are gamer fuel, though.
There's nothing better to gear up for a Magic tournament than with a large stack of pancakes.
Right. You know, I was talking about it a little bit. As you say that you have a really good basic pancake recipe, well, buttermilk pancake recipe anyway, I had been using the recipe that was in Joy of Cooking, which I love. The Joy of Cooking as a cookbook. They have a lot of good information beyond even recipes, but I think that their pancake recipe is flawed.
Which seems crazy, because how many printings must Joy of Cooking have?
I don't know, but I think my correction for it was to add an extra half cup of flour and an extra half teaspoon of baking powder, because they were coming out way, way too thin. And I'm, you know, after following the directions, they're still coming out thin and they're just not very good. So, but that seemed to help. And actually the last time I made that recipe with the correction and substituted the half cup of added flour with a half cup of buckwheat flour, which actually, that was nice. They had a good buckwheat flavor, which is sort of nutty and whole grainy, but that was good too.
Do you put anything else in your pancakes, or do you usually just enjoy them straight?
I guess all of those recipes have a little bit of nutmeg and a little bit of cinnamon, usually, and some vanilla.
I mean,
I'm fine with
blueberries or apples and stuff like that.
I did put blueberries in some of the buckwheat cakes, and a lot of times we put blueberries in the cottage cheese pancakes. And actually, I think I've used peaches and strawberries in the cottage cheese pancakes too. And all of those have been really good. The peaches were a little bit subtle, like they didn't add a whole bunch of flavor. But everything has been, those pancakes are just really hard to mess up. They're always good.
I saw a hypothetical online that says you're in business and you sit down to breakfast with a powerful business client and he orders chocolate chip pancakes. What do you think of this? And my answer to that is, guy likes
awesome.
Chocolate chip pancakes. What's wrong with that? Because one of the reasons why I ask you what you put in your pancakes is because chocolate chip pancakes is one of the things that we do when we're making really delicious pancakes.
I've never made chocolate chip pancakes myself.
Really? It's really good.
Well, I mean, you're putting chocolate chips in a pancake. Do you still put syrup on them?
No. It's just butter and the chocolate chips. You don't want to mix the syrup and the chocolate.
What about strawberry syrup? And put fruit syrup on there?
That sounds awesome.
Yeah. I mean, I was just wondering.
Yeah, I would do that.
Yeah. We should do this. well, yeah, I've never made chocolate chip pancakes before, and I can't remember ever having ordered them at a restaurant.
In general, I have found that there are other types of pancakes that I would rather order in a restaurant.
Right.
Because, like, chocolate chip pancakes are really easy.
Right.
Like, it's a lot more effort involved to make apple pancakes, which is another
right.
thing that I enjoy eating at a restaurant. Chocolate chips is just like, yep, I got this gigantic bag of chocolate chips from Costco, and I'm going to put some in a pancake. Got there.
What were you going to say, Stephen?
I just made comment. They're delicious because the chocolate's all melty in the pancakes.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
But no,
yeah, it's amazing.
Guys, if I ever come up to your area to play Vintage, we are having pancakes.
Man,
sure.
Yeah, we should definitely go to, like, Black River Cafe.
We should probably hawk Black River Cafe because it is amazing.
Yeah, Black River Cafe is a small diner in Oberlin, Ohio that has, they have, I guess they would have 9 different kinds of pancakes that you could choose because they have buttermilk, cornmeal, and is it multigrain?
Yes.
And then 3 different kinds of filling. So I guess it's actually 12 because you can have plain pancakes. But they, or is it 4 different kinds of filling? I think they have chocolate chips, raspberry, blueberry, and apple.
Yeah.
And actually, you might be able to combine those. I don't know why you wouldn't be able to. But their pancakes are excellent.
Yeah, the entire place is really just sort of, I mean, let's be honest, it's a place owned by hippies that wants to serve food to hippies, so you know that they're all natural and delicious.
Yeah. Do you guys have anywhere like that in Iowa? Where do you go for pancakes?
Oh god, where do I? I think I tell my mom that pancakes would sound delicious.
That's good enough. I have no problem with that.
Unfortunately, where I'm at, there is more chains than anything else, but.
Yeah, IHOP makes
a mean pancake.
I was gonna say, I've never been to an IHOP before.
Right. We, a lot of times on vacation, we'll go to an IHOP for breakfast or a Denny's, and, their pancakes are solid.
Yeah, they're good. I mean, granted, it's kind of hard to screw up a pancake, but.
Right. Well, I mean, especially when you're making one.
Right.
You should see some of my pancakes where I forget that I'm making pancakes. That's a screwed up pancake for you.
Well, and those ones out of the Joy of Cooking that were a little thin, those were pretty bad.
Yeah, that can be a shame. You just end up with something that's sort of like a limp.
Yeah, but not like a crepe.
Not like a crepe.
It's just a terrible pancake.
You might be able to make a simulated crepe out of it.
You might.
You're getting close there.
Right. You know, speaking of crepes, because there are excellent crepes. I think crepes are one of those trending foods right now.
Yeah, I agree.
For people going to Vintage Champs, there's an excellent creperie in Philadelphia.
How did you get hooked up on a creperie in Philadelphia, if I may ask?
When we were living in D.C., we went with a couple of friends up to Philadelphia to tour Eastern State Penitentiary, which is an excellent tourist destination if you're interested in prisons? Okay, for a long time it was the longest active penitentiary in the United States because it was open from the 1700s. I know that Benjamin Franklin had a hand in its opening. So from the 1700s until I think the 1970s. So it was open for, 200 years or close to it. And
never got more plumbing.
They told some of the different theories of actual penal life that were developed through that time. So, I mean, the first prison cells there were totally solitary. You talked to and heard no one except God. And that was how you did your penance, was that, you sat and thought about what you did and talked to God about it. And when you were done, that was how you did penance.
The ultimate time out and think about what you've done.
Yeah, pretty much. And as you went on, they installed the electric chair and, things like that. So there were different kinds of punishments doled out. It was a really interesting tour that they gave. They had a whole bunch of stuff going on, the actual different cell blocks from different eras and things like that. It was pretty cool. So anyway, we went up to Philadelphia to tour that and also to tour the Olympia, which is the last warship from the Spanish-American War.
Stop spelling. What's the creperie?
It's Café Beaumont.
Ah, Café Beaumont.
Yeah, and so they had insane crepes, and you could get appetizer crepes and entree crepes and dessert crepes. So if you wanted a meal filled with crepe, they had it. It was a crepey meal, but... So yeah, I would highly recommend going there when you're in Philadelphia for Vintage Champs. If you have time not playing Vintage, perhaps on Saturday during the Legacy Tournament, you can go tour Eastern State Penitentiary too.
Is that anywhere near the convention? Actually, where is the Vintage Champs being held?
I assume Vintage Champs is at the Convention Center, which is actually across the street from, it's really not anywhere near there, but so you'll have to probably take a car.
Fair enough.
But it's interesting to get to, wouldn't worry too much about that, and the food is excellent, and the neighborhood is kind of cool, so you can go there and spend some time after the tournament or whatever.
Neat.
Yeah. So, highly recommend that one. I guess crepes are like a pancake.
They are really like a pancake.
Yeah. Actually, speaking of pancakes, at the Reading Terminal Market in Philadelphia, there's actually a diner there that has really good pancakes. I think it is probably the Down Home Diner.
Where's your preparation now?
But
come on.
I didn't know we were going to, I didn't know I was going to be talking about pancake places. But anyway, Down Home Diner at Reading Terminal Market, which is within a block easily of the convention center, they have really good pancakes as well as other breakfast food. Like if you were planning on going out to get breakfast before tournaments on the Eternal Weekend, I highly recommend that, although it will probably be crowded so early.
I would, in general, highly recommend breakfast before tournaments because it's a great way to hang out with friends, and also it's probably the best way to ensure that you don't get those fourth or fifth round hunger pangs that cause you to crash and burn.
Yeah, I get those anyway. Yeah, no, I think breakfast is very important.
It's happened again. You've wasted another perfectly good hour listening to Serious Vintage. I'm Jeff Mose.
And I'm Nat Mose. And we've been here with Steven Stearman, the Four Color Humans player from Gen Con. Thanks very much for being here, Steven.
Thanks for having me.
And we hope you'll join us next time for more Serious Vintage. Take a little trip, take a little trip, take a little trip and see.
I'm probably going to go make pancakes now, to be completely honest.